Welcome to the Healthy Podcast, where we invite you to invest in your well-being and unlock the secrets of vibrant health, peak performance, and wellness. Join us, Sebastian Mirau and Johannes Kettelhout, co-founders of Australia and New Zealand's leading wellness company, as we dive deep into the science, strategies, and stories that empower you to live your healthiest, happiest life. Whether you are a CEO, high achiever, entrepreneur, elite athlete, health enthusiast, scientist, or self-improvement seeker, together we will explore the cutting edge of biohacking techniques and holistic health practices with world-class experts that optimize your mind, body, and spirit. With each episode, you will walk away with practical and actionable steps to integrate in your daily life. Are you ready? Let's elevate your well-being.
G'day everyone to another show of the Healthy Show. Long in the making, but I'm finally stoked to have you on here, Greg. Greg, you're an expert on light biology. We talked about that earlier before the interview. You're a coach, you're a writer, you're a consultant, you hold a PhD. I'll let you explain all of that. But I think for someone who really is fascinated and interested in health, especially with a chronobiology, chronic nutrition perspective, I think they probably have seen your face. I'm very happy to have you here. And I'll leave you to tell us the full story of who you are and, you know, what your PhD is about and what you're passionate about.
Thanks, Johannes. And yeah, lovely to finally speak with you because we have been trying to organize this for several months and it's probably generally my fault that it's been pushed back. But I'll give you a very brief synopsis because there are a few questions in there. But I academically did my PhD in sleep, nutrition, and metabolism. And within that, I was particularly interested in chronobiology and how that relates to nutrition specifically. Before that, I did a master's in exercise physiology, and then my undergrad was in sport and exercise science. And so over the years, since the age of 19 or so, I've coached people in various different capacities. And initially, a lot of that work was with strength and power athletes, but more recently, some of that's been with ultra endurance athletes. And also nowadays, most of it focuses on people with chronic health conditions, including sleep and circadian biology issues. I also do various different pieces of consultancy work, as you alluded to. So some of that is working with a US-based supplement company where I'm a scientific advisor, but I'm leading the formulation of their first product, which is hopefully coming to market around the end of this year. I work with a business that runs retreats and I deliver some of the sessions there. I do lots of different things. I sometimes joke that I have 8 part-time jobs, but the common thread that runs through them all is that I'm interested in helping people sustainably improve their health and performance through lifestyle and environmental changes. And I really enjoy my work and my work in science communication too, which is part of the reason why around a year ago, I actually started my own podcast, which is called Reason and Wellbeing. And so if people find today's conversation interesting, they might enjoy some of those episodes too. But I'll stop there and I'll leave aside the things I'm personally interested in for now.
Right. I think we'll link to the podcast down below. So if anyone's curious, you got introduced to me by a very good friend, Boomer. You know, we chatted up earlier and he said, you're the man for everything. Chronobiology, circadian rhythm. I think the effects technically of light on the human health, human body metabolism. Are you able to give us maybe a bit of an intro on what actually chronobiology is, what it means, what is the circadian rhythm? I know I'm shooting a lot of questions at you, but sure. I feel like you can't really answer one without the other. So I think we kind of really have to probably paint a broader picture at the start.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll try and give you some of the highlights. So chronobiology is really the study of time structures in living beings, which might sound quite vague and conceptual. So I'll try and give you some examples to help make sense of it. You mentioned circadian rhythms, and this brings up the idea that our bodies have their own intrinsic rhythms in various different processes, and they occur across different timescales. So the shortest of these rhythms recur multiple times every 24 hours, and they're called ultradian rhythms. Examples of these would be things like your heartbeat, the cycles of sleep that you go through each night. You also have what are called circadian rhythms. Circa means about, and dies means day. So these recur roughly once every 24 hours. And some of the most prominent ones include your sleep-wake cycle, which some people would argue is not actually a true circadian rhythm, and is instead driven by other circadian rhythms. But to give an example of one of those others, you have your melatonin rhythm, which is often actually studied by chronobiologists to try and work out where you are within your biological day or biological night. You also have roughly 24-hour fluctuations in things like your core body temperature that influence your exercise performance, for instance, such that around your late biological afternoon, which for most people is going to be roughly 6 p.m., your core body temperature is highest, and that is the time at which you are your strongest and most powerful. So if you are trying to do a one rep max in a bench press or a squat in the gym, that time of day is probably ideal for that type of performance. And it's therefore no coincidence that if you look, for instance, at world records that are set in track and field, they tend to cluster in the late afternoon and evening. Some of that is due to scheduling, of course, but some of that is probably also a function of intrinsic biology. Then you have the longest rhythms, and these are called infradian rhythms. And there aren't many clear examples of these in humans. Probably the most conspicuous is the menstrual cycle. And in men, it's not that clear that there are any of these. However, one important point is that the environments that we live in now are quite different from those in which we evolved. And so it could be that we do have some infradian rhythms, but that nowadays those are masked by changes in our environment that make it hard to identify those. There are some seasonal fluctuations in various things. If you look, for instance, at levels of testosterone and other sex steroids, then some of them are higher during the long days of summer than they are during the short days of winter. And whether that's a true infradian rhythm isn't clear. It might just be driven by light exposure per se, but that might be one of the reasons why some of us feel a bit friskier during the summer than we do during the winter. And there might be a few other very small fluctuations, but certainly in other animals, there are obvious infradian rhythms. And this would include instances such as sheep giving birth at very discrete times each year, deer shedding their antlers at specific times of year, and so on. And the reason why we have these different rhythms across different timescales is to anticipate changes in the environment that ultimately influence our ability to stay alive and pass on our genes. And organisms are evolved to exist in different temporal niches. And what I mean by that is that some organisms are daytime active, diurnal, like humans. Some are crepuscular, so they're most active around dawn and dusk. Some of them are nocturnal, they're most active during darkness. And there are probably various different factors that influence why that's the case. Some of it relates to energy conservation. Some of it relates to avoiding threats from predators. But an important concept to understand is that if you were trying to do everything all the time, all at once, so all of your body systems were in high gear, then that would be very energetically costly. And so because of that, we've evolved this fluctuating biology that schedules different events at different times of day. And broadly, we can liken this to participating in a race during the day. So if you think about a Formula One car, then speeding around the track, and that's necessary to participate in the race, which I suppose in biological terms would be passing on your genes. But with that comes damage and the need to replace tires. and repair various structures and fill up the tank. And so because of that, we need this process or this period of quiescence, sleep, in which we can detach from the environment and do some of that repair. So that's an example of how our biology is segregated into different periods in order to serve different functions. And going back to something I mentioned earlier, part of the problem is that nowadays we live in environments where we no longer give our bodies clocks that produce these rhythmic changes in our biology, strong time cues, such as clear, consistent cycles of light exposure and darkness, eating and fasting, activity and rest. And because of this, our clocks can start to function worse and lose their timing relationships with each other. And this is thought to give rise to various different health conditions and also performance impairments too. And so if we can understand this underlying chronobiology and the time cues that influence it, then we can improve the function of our body's clocks and ultimately improve our health and performance.
All right, to figure out that a little better. Wow, there was a lot of amazing things in there. And I guess a lot of the things will open up pathways to, you know, to other topics that we'll touch on. But you touched on, I think, these rhythms being prominent, for instance, in women, like with the menopause. Is that the only difference between men and women, broadly speaking, or are there more?
Yeah, there are certainly more. And this hasn't been that well studied, as is true of so many different fields of scientific inquiry. Females have largely been neglected in research, at least historically, and the tide has started to turn. But because of that, most of our understanding of human biological rhythms is based on studies of males. With that said, we do know something about some differences in their biological rhythms. And I'll just give some examples. So you mentioned the menstrual cycle, and that is a particularly prominent one. But thinking about the circadian rhythm, so these roughly 24-hour rhythms, there seems to be a few differences. So one of them is that the intrinsic periodicity, the duration of the circadian cycle, the duration of the internal day, is actually slightly shorter in women than it is in men on average. And so if you took a group of 25-year-old men and a group of 25-year-old women, and you put them under a standardized light-dark cycle and eating schedule, you would find that on average, the women go to sleep and wake up slightly earlier than the men. And that's because of the fact that if you then put these people in what's called temporal isolation, where there are no time cues, there's no change in the light dark cycle, there's no fluctuation in the availability of food, there's no fluctuation in environmental temperature, and you measured the timing of their internal clocks, you looked, for example, at their core body temperature rhythm, or you looked at their melatonin rhythm, then you would find that on average the duration of the internal rhythm is about 24 hours and 12 minutes, but in women it would be slightly faster than that, slightly shorter than that. And in men, it would be slightly slower, slightly longer. So maybe for women, it would be 24 hours and 6 minutes. And for men, it would be 24 hours and 18 minutes. So that's one factor. Women and men seem to respond slightly differently to circadian disruption. And again, this hasn't been that well studied. There's been a bit of research looking at the effects of disrupting circadian rhythms and also disrupting sleep and whether there are sex differences. And there seem to be some minor differences if you look at things like how certain hormones that are involved in appetite regulation respond, or how patterns of electrical activity in the brain respond to sleep deprivation if you then put delicious food or images of delicious food in front of men and women, or if you then measure their food intake. It seems that there are small differences in the degree to which men and women will overeat under those conditions. So there certainly are some differences, but I'd argue that right now it's quite hard to clearly say that these are the sweeping differences in how men and women respond to circadian disruption and sleep disruption. But the most conspicuous differences really are the menstrual cycle and the fact that the intrinsic biological day, and I keep saying biological day and biological night, what I'm referring to there is that there are times when your body is ready for activity and food intake and challenging yourself cognitively, and that is the biological day. And then there are times when your body is primed for resting and fasting and sleep, and that is the biological night time. And the reason I refer to biological day and biological night is that it's not the same time of day for all people. So if you look at an extreme early bird or morning lark, and you look at an extreme night owl, late type, then you might find that at 8 p.m., the early bird is ready to go to bed and getting ready to wind down, whereas the night owl is in high gear. And it feels like the middle of the afternoon for them. So I just wanted to spell that out. So there are some differences. They're not that well understood. I think the important thing that people need to grasp is that we should be thinking about the timing of our behaviors relative to the biological day and the biological night, which is going to vary between people depending on all sorts of factors, including biological sex, with women on average being slightly earlier than men, at least up to around the menopausal transition. And therefore, we can frame when we want to engage in certain behaviors relative to the sleep-wake cycle. I think that's most practical because in research, the timing of behaviors relative to the body's clock is often considered relative to either the core body temperature rhythm or the melatonin rhythm, because they are really strong, high amplitude rhythms that are driven by the body's clock per se. But in the real world, those are hard to measure right now. Certainly, you can get some sense of body temperature based on the temperature of the skin at your wrist, for example, if you're wearing a Fitbit or something like that. And interestingly, the actual rhythm of that skin temperature is roughly out of phase with the core body temperature rhythm. So as your core body temperature is going up, your skin temperature is often going down. But with that said, because most of us sleep at roughly the same time relative to our body's clock, so most of us will fall asleep about 2 hours after a sharp rise in melatonin production in the brain, which is that marker of biological rhythms I mentioned. Just thinking about things relative to the sleep-wake cycle is most practical. So I'll pause there because, again, that was a relatively long answer.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's, you know, my brain was kind of wondering, it's like, how do you actually research that, hey? Because it's so complex. You have so many moving parts at the same time. And then you obviously have the unique individual. And I think we all are unique, although you can obviously see patterns. And yeah, I'm sure there's, yeah, it's a very complex field. But nonetheless, I think truly meaningful, right? Really understanding how we actually react to it. And I think in particular, what you said about women, I can only confirm that because, you know, we do a lot of research, or not necessarily actively, but we are fed, you know, we're questioned by customers on research around red light therapy, ice bath, and saunas, and it's predominantly for men, you know, and I'm sure there are differences, which I'll, you know, I want to pick your brain on. Yeah. I think before we go there, one of the things I would love to hear from you is, you know, obviously, I think everyone by now, everyone at least who listens to this show sort of understands that we have a circadian rhythm, that live in the morning sort of helps to reset, you know, the circadian rhythm to some extent. But could you picture an ideal day? I mean, I know there is probably no such ideal day because it depends on the chronotype and where someone's at in their journey. But the other thing I have in my mind is obviously shift work, which I would argue, and you probably agree with me, there's the extreme opposite of what an ideal day should look like. And can we draw some lines between those two?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's probably worth taking a step back and just briefly mentioning that in order to reset our clocks each day, bearing in mind that they don't tick at precisely 24 hours, we need to give them strong time cues, which raises the question, what are those time cues? And in humans, the most important for the central clock or the master clock in the circadian system is your patterns of exposure to light and darkness. And we can think about this system of clocks with the central clock at the helm as being a bit like an orchestra. And within this orchestra, the central or the master clock is the conductor. So it helps keep the timing of all these clocks elsewhere in other tissues in time, so that the result is a beautiful symphony rather than just noise pollution. And we have clocks likely in every cell in our body, at least some sort of clock. And those program when to build structures in cells each day, when to break down structures in cells each day. You can look at it from the perspective of different organs too. So when the gut is best able to digest and take up nutrients, when the pancreas produces insulin most effectively during the day, when the muscles most effectively produce force, when the brain is primed for cognitive activity versus clearing wastes and so on. And so we need to time all of these different processes appropriately relative to the other clocks. And the master clock in the brain is key to that and is most responsive to light, specifically at the eyes. And so if we were going to give our master clock a strong time cue each day, that would mean lots of high intensity, short wavelength, rich light during the waking day, which would equate to spending plenty of time outdoors. And if you're indoors, it would mean sitting by the window and having strong overhead lighting that's rich in short wavelength. So it might look quite white or even slightly blue or slightly green. And then at night, having low intensity, short wavelength depleted light, relatively low in the environment. So if you think about this in evolutionary terms, then you can imagine mimicking the light environment of our distant ancestors, which if they were anywhere near the equator, would mean that they would be exposed to a very small amount of light from the moon and the stars. And then otherwise they would build fires. And so that light would be low down and it would look quite amber. So it'd be rich in long wavelength light, meaning that in our modern environments, we might use things like lamps low down at night and choose ones that have quite a warm color. So they might look quite red or amber, and they would only be bright enough for what's needed for us to see and therefore avoid tripping up and so on. So the light-dark cycle is key, but then there are all of the clocks outside of this master clock in the brain, and these are broadly referred to as peripheral clocks. And these seem to not only respond to the light-dark cycle, the degree to which they do is somewhat unclear and likely dependent on the tissue in question, but they also are influenced by timing of your activity and rest. So if you think about your skeletal muscles, for example, if you consistently work out in the morning, then it would be helpful if the clocks in your muscles and your connective tissues, your joints and your bones, perhaps, and perhaps your heart as well, would anticipate you being active at that time so that they could get into high gear to ensure that your performance is best supported in the morning. And it does seem that when you are active each day will help influence the timing of some of these clocks so that they can anticipate what's going to most likely happen during the day. But interestingly, the timing of your exercise does seem to be slightly able to shift the timing of the master clock in the brain. It hasn't been that well studied yet, but broadly speaking, the relationship between when you're active and how the timing of your master clock changes is quite similar to light. So with light exposure, if you get lots of high intensity, short wavelength, rich light in the biological morning, so between about 2 hours before you would naturally wake up and a few hours after you naturally wake up, that tends to accelerate your clock, meaning that you're going to be able to more easily fall asleep early the following evening and wake up early the following day. And this is why at the level of the population, it's good advice for most people to see light in the morning shortly after waking, because a lot of people go to bed quite late and then they have to curtail their sleep opportunity by waking to an alarm in order to be up on time for work. However, there are some people who absolutely don't want to go to bed earlier, and this is commonly the case in later life. There are many people in their 70s and 80s who find themselves falling asleep at 7 p.m. And so if they were seeing lots of light shortly after waking, they would just be getting earlier still and losing time with the rest of society, which might be bad for their social lives, for instance. And so at the other side of the day, between a few hours before you go to bed and right up to about 2 hours before you wake up, if you get lots of light at that time of day, then you're going to slow down your clock, pushing your sleep later. And so for the older person, this is the prime time to get lots of light shortly before they go to bed. And going back to exercise, if you do strenuous exercise in the biological morning, that will likely accelerate your clock as well. Whereas if you do strenuous exercise late in the day, that might well slow your clock a little bit. The relationships might be slightly different for people who are extreme early birds or extreme night owls though. And then finally, with respect to nutrition, nutrition seems to be able to influence some of your peripheral clocks too. And it would make sense if when you eat most strongly influence the timing of clocks that are in tissues involved in digestion and metabolism. So those tissues would be things like the stomach, the intestines, the liver, pancreas, and so on. And there's some evidence, certainly from non-human animals, that this is indeed the case. Nutrition doesn't seem so able to influence the timing of the master clock in the brain, though, which again does make some sense in evolutionary terms. But what this means is that once more, your body is going to anticipate food intake at times at which you regularly consume meals. And that's why if you are used to having breakfast at 9 a.m. each day, there will probably be a large spike in your body's production of the food intake promoting hormone ghrelin around that time, even if you don't eat. And you can see pulses in ghrelin that coincide with habitual meal times. So giving your body clear cycles of eating and fasting and regular meal times is likely conducive to healthy high amplitude rhythms in the circadian system, and specifically the circadian clocks in these tissues that are involved in digestion and metabolism. So going back to your initial question, if we're thinking about setting up an ideal day, then we need to bear in mind that the ideal day is going to be somewhat chronotype dependent. So whether you're more of an early bird or a night owl. But with that said, we can speak in general terms and give people what I think is helpful advice. So first, if you're an early bird, you're trying to shift later, then you would want to actually avoid light in the first couple of hours after waking and get plenty of light between about 4 hours before your target bedtime and 2 hours before your target bedtime. That's going to help push your clock later. If you're a night owl, however, and you're trying to shift earlier, then you want to get lots of light exposure in the 2 hours or so after waking, and then avoid light certainly in the 3 hours before you go to bed, using some of those strategies that I touched on earlier. Although if you wanted to go the biohacking route and you didn't mind looking silly, you could wear blue blocking glasses at that time. They do seem to be effective in reducing the amount of short wavelength rich light that reaches the eye. So for night owls, I'll be using those in the 3 hours or so before bedtime. And for early birds, it might be using those in the 2 hours or so after waking. Then in terms of your activity timing, for most people, the best time at which to exercise is likely the biological afternoon. And being pragmatic, that might be around the end of the waking day for a lot of people. At that time, performance is likely to be highest. And there's some evidence from certain diseased populations, people with diabetes, for instance, that exercising in the afternoon seems to be slightly better for metabolic control than exercise in the morning. There are probably some confounding variables in those studies, but speaking in general terms, that does seem to be the case. And it's not only related to performance, but it's also related to the fact that in some ways your body's clockwork results in changes that make your body slightly less resilient to some of the stresses involved in exercise in the biological morning. So to give you an example of this, if you look at heart attacks, they cluster in the morning. Most heart attacks occur relatively early in the day, and it's because the cardiovascular system is more vulnerable at that time, which is a product in part of the fact that there are changes in things like levels of stress hormones, your heart rate variability, various different factors that are involved in the formation of clots in your blood at that time that make you more vulnerable to cardiovascular issues. So for a lot of people, the best time of day which to do strenuous exercise is going to be the late biological afternoon, but exercise is really important and we need to meet people where they're at. And so I would say if you want to work out shortly after waking, then that's likely going to be good for you if you're a night owl anyway. But just make sure that you've got a sufficient warm-up before any workouts that are occurring not that long after waking. I would certainly not do anything really strenuous, like lifting very heavy weights within half an hour of waking. Ideally, I think you'd be up at least an hour before your exercise and then just spend some additional time warming up in the morning to raise your core body temperature to a level that's closer to what it would be in the biological afternoon anyway. And that way you're going to support your performance, but also help potentially reduce your risk of various issues, which could be injuries, but could also relate to the function of your cardiovascular system. And then otherwise, in terms of low to moderate intensity exercise, you can distribute that relatively evenly across your waking day, I think, without too much concern. So if I were going to say, here are the hard cutoffs, I would avoid very strenuous exercise in the hour after waking. And I would also avoid it in the 3 hours before sleep, not just because of any effects of the exercise on your body's clocks, but also because strenuous exercise is a stressor. And so because of that, you're going to dramatically increase the activity in the sympathetic or the fight or flight branch of your nervous system. And that plus some other changes are going to make it harder for you to then fall asleep if you do that too close to bedtime. So finish that at least 3 hours before bed. And then regarding your nutrition, in general, it seems that the changes that take place in your digestive system, in your endocrine system, and so on, prime your body for food intake in the first half of the waking day. There have been many studies in the last few years of what's called time-restricted eating, which I'm sure listeners are familiar with by now. But the way that I would define it is only consuming anything that contains calories in a period of 12 hours or less each day. For a lot of people, they spread out their calorie intake over a much longer period than that. There are studies showing that in parts of North America, the number is close to 14 to 15 hours a day. So people are actually consuming calories for most of the time that they're awake each day. But time-restricted eating is commonly practiced as an eating window of 8 to 10 hours or so. So if you open that window at 10 a.m., then you might finish that window by 6 p.m., which would be an 8-hour eating window, for instance. And there have been studies that have looked at what's called early time-restricted eating. And the way that this is enacted in many of these studies, bearing in mind that these studies typically don't take the extremes of chronotypes, so they don't include people who are very owlish, many of these early time-restricted eating studies will have people finish their final meal by 3 p.m. And the time-restricted eating studies that have shown the most dramatic positive effects on measures of metabolic control and cardiovascular health, so things like blood pressure, blood sugar control, have used that type of early time-restricted eating approach. And there are lots of underlying reasons behind that. One of them is likely that if you look at your blood sugar control, then the clocks that are involved in regulating that, like the clock in the pancreas that produces insulin, the clocks in your skeletal muscles and your fat tissue that influence uptake of glucose and so on, result in a relatively high amplitude daytime, nighttime difference in your oral glucose tolerance, such that the degree to which your blood sugar swings following a meal at 8 p.m. is substantially greater than following a meal at 8 a.m. So front loading your fat intake and your carbohydrate intake within whatever eating window you choose is often a good strategy, but you should also account for when you are active each day. So if you can only work out hard at 6 p.m., then I think it's fine to consume a substantial proportion of your calories relatively late in the day, because you want to fuel that activity, but also that activity is going to do some damage. You can have some exercise-induced muscle damage, for example, that you then want to repair. And the activity might also, depending on things like the intensity and the amount of damage that it induces, could have some positive effects on how your body responds to any foods that you consume as well. That's certainly true of the protein that you consume. So if you can only work out late in the day, I think it's okay to have plenty of your carbohydrate intake in particular around that time. But again, thinking about some bright lines that we can draw in the sand, I would probably not eat anything in the first hour or so after waking. There are lots of reasons for that, but one of them is just that around the time that you wake up each day, there's a sharp spike in your body's production of the stress hormone cortisol. This is called the cortisol awakening response. That's to anticipate the day ahead. So it increases your blood pressure, it mobilizes energy reserves like stores of carbohydrate and fatty acids too, in order to fuel your body for the upcoming stresses of the day ahead. But with that surge in cortisol, you might find that temporarily your blood sugar is slightly worsened by some of those changes that are taking place. So wait at least an hour after waking before consuming anything. And then at the other side of the day, I'd certainly avoid consuming anything that contains calories at least 2 hours before bed. And I think for a lot of people, earlier still would be preferable. Regarding the size of the eating window, I think for most people, a window of anywhere from about 6 to 12 hours can work well. I would favor the longer end of that range if you either struggle to maintain your weight or you're actively trying to gain weight in a healthy way. Whereas if you are struggling to lose weight and you want to, you could favor the shorter end of that range. And I think something around 8 hours is going to work well for many people. Time-restricted eating isn't for everyone. Right now, as is the case for pretty much anything you care to look at, I don't think people would recommend it for pregnant women. I actually think that it would probably be perfectly healthy for those people, but we just have to be extra cautious with that population. I certainly wouldn't recommend it for people who have very, very high energy expenditures, as is true of some athletes. So if you're a Tour de France cyclist and you're trying to stick to a 6 hour time-restricted eating window, you're crazy. And if you have reproductive issues too, which are driven by chronic low energy availability, you just haven't been consuming enough energy and carbohydrate in particular, it's not for you. If you have a history of disordered eating or a frank eating disorder, it's probably not for you either, especially things like binge eating disorder or bulimia nervosa. It could be that people will try time-restricted eating and all they're doing is exacerbating those cycles of binging and purging. But for most people, it's going to work quite well. And then within the eating window that you choose, I would try and have relatively consistent meal times from day to day. And I'd probably space those meals anywhere from about 3 to 6 hours apart. So if you're using a 6 hour window, you could have just two meals within that or three meals. If you're having a 12 hour eating window though, you'd probably want 3 to 5 meals within that, depending on what suits your schedule, whether you're trying to gain weight and so on. And I'd try and distribute my protein intake relatively evenly across those different meals too, because of the roles of protein in appetite regulation and body composition. So specifically your fat-free mass and keeping that as high as possible. And then finally, there are specific nutrients that I should probably mention, as well as constituents of foods that will influence your body's clock function, but also your sleep independent of your clock. The most obvious of these are caffeine and alcohol. And so regarding caffeine, there are massive differences between people in how they metabolize caffeine, depending on all sorts of factors, genetics, the health of the liver, whether they smoke, whether they take medications. And with that said, I think a helpful guideline for most people is to not consume any caffeine for the 9 hours or so before their habitual bedtime. And you want to play around with your caffeine intake because you might find that you need to finish earlier still. And then obviously the dose matters too, because the higher the dose, the longer it's going to take for your body to clear the caffeine. And so if you are having a heroic dose of caffeine, you'd want that as early in your day as possible if you're trying to avoid disrupting your sleep. But I think for most people, keeping their caffeine intake to no more than about 3 milligrams of caffeine per kilogram of body weight per day is a good place to start. So to exemplify that, if you're 80 kilograms, 80 times 3 is 240 milligrams of caffeine. 240 milligrams of caffeine is about the amount of caffeine that's in 2 high-quality store-bought Americano coffees made with Arabica coffee, or it's about the equivalent of 4 instant coffees, assuming that we're talking about a typical size instant coffee. But again, those will depend on all sorts of factors. And then finally, regarding alcohol, the rate at which people metabolize alcohol also varies a lot between people. But if I had to provide some very generic guidance, then on average, people will metabolize alcohol at a rate of roughly 1 unit per hour. And I like to add a small amount of leeway in there too, just bearing in mind there are some people who are metabolizing it substantially slower than that. And so, in terms of cutoffs, I think the recommendation to finish your alcohol should correspond to the number of units you consume. And so, if you had 2 units of alcohol, which is about the amount in a medium glass of wine or a pint of beer, then that should be 1 hour per unit. So that's 2 hours plus that 1 hour of leeway. So you'd want to finish that pint of beer at least 3 hours before bedtime. And if you're having 2 pints of beer, so 4 units, that would be at least 5 hours before 4 plus 1. And I know that can seem a bit neurotic, and I don't want people to worry too much about these things. And if you occasionally have several drinks, maybe one drink too many, then that's fine if it's occasional and you've had a good time and you've been out with your friends and so on. But I think as a day-to-day recommendation, that can work well if you're someone who consumes alcohol on most days each week. Again, though, generally speaking, the earlier the better. I sometimes joke that the best time for a beer is breakfast, because if you don't want to disrupt your sleep, then that's likely the case. And maybe it'll be conducive to creativity at work as well. So another very long response, but hopefully there's some helpful stuff in there.
And love, oops, there was a ton of knowledge in there, eh? It's like, yeah, I was kind of keen on kind of taking my notepad here and writing the notes. I'll probably have to do this after the podcast, because I think especially some of these equations were new to me. I mean, I knew about caffeine, I knew about alcohol, but I feel like nowadays we're more often than not, or at least that's what we see on social media, we're talking about, you got to do X amount of grams of protein, you need kind of vegan versus carnivore. And I feel like, with everything that you've just said, it's, there's a whole other argument to be made here, that probably the diet is not irrelevant, but it probably, it's not the only, the only source of good or bad or weight loss or overall health. But, I think this whole timing piece, to me at least, is not narrated in a really good way, so that people actually understand that it's really about the day-to-day things that you apply on a daily basis.
Yeah, and I also wrestle with how I communicate these ideas, because I think speaking in milligrams of caffeine and units of alcohol is a bit like me speaking, trying to speak in French very badly. And for people who don't speak French, they're just not going to understand what I'm on about. And so I think you also, over time, can work out some rules of thumb regarding what those recommendations correspond to. So if I think about myself, for instance, then I know that I'm a coffee snob. I like good coffee, and I drink coffee from an AeroPress for the most part. And that's a similar strength to consuming a store-bought Americano with 2 shots. So if I have a 200 to 240 mil AeroPress, it's got roughly the amount of caffeine that's in that store-bought Americano. So I know that for me, I can have 2 coffees the way that I normally make it with my AeroPress, and I know what my cutoff time is in the morning. And then after that, if I want more caffeine, I'll just make sure it's from, if I want more coffee, I'll just make sure that it's a decaf coffee. So you might think about the drinks, the caffeinated drinks that you consume on a regular basis, get a rough idea of the amount of caffeine that's in those, and then just come up with your own guidelines. So if you like instant coffee and you're 60 kilos, then 6 times 3, that's 180. Okay, that's 3 to 4 instant coffees. So I can have 3 to 4 instant coffees each day because I don't drink tea, which also contains caffeine. And I think I'm a bit of a slow metabolizer. So he said 9 hours, but maybe going to make that 10 hours for me. So I can have 3 or 4 coffees each day before midday because I normally go to bed at about 10 p.m. And that's going to be about right for me. So you can translate this to your situation. The same goes for alcohol. Monday to Friday, I don't always drink in the evening, but if I do drink, I'm going to have a glass of red wine and it's going to be a large glass because YOLO. And that's probably going to contain 2.5 units of alcohol, something like that, maybe even 3 units. So I'm going to have that as early as possible after I've finished work and got in. Maybe I'm going to have that while I'm preparing dinner. And then I'm going to try and stick to that meal timing recommendation and finish my dinner at least 3 hours before bed. And okay, I find out that over time that works quite well for me too. So yeah, I always feel slightly torn about how to describe these recommendations because there are some people who like quantifying things, and then there are some people who are much more intuitive about things. And actually, it's often the case that it's most helpful for the people who are quantitatively disposed to loosen up a little bit and worry a bit less about some of the minutiae and more about how they think about these things and balancing different aspects of their lives, because I'm sure it's the same for you. I've spent plenty of time among many biohacker types over the years, and they micromanage their lives and major in the minors in a way that ultimately is to their detriment.
Well, I agree. I think, almost becomes a little bit neurotic that, if you actually miss out of your 10-step game plan to conquer the night, you might actually cause yourself more stress as opposed to, trying to achieve the overall goal, which is to feel good, to be happy, and have a good night's sleep ahead, right? So I feel like along those lines, for full transparency, we sell infrared saunas and ice baths, right? But my natural reaction to these is to use a sauna before bedtime. I just, you know, I for me personally, it helps me downregulate my nervous system. It's kind of long wavelength light too. Oftentimes it's far infrared, right? Which is kind of in line with what you're saying. And I do tend to do an ice bath in the morning, especially if I've not had a good sleep, if I've got a, pretty busy day ahead of me. But I've always wondered, especially about the ice baths in the morning, whether it's not just actually causing too much stress. Obviously, ideally, you do it on the beach and, you kind of have that light at the same time as the cold. But, more often than not, it's actually indoors or a cold shower or something. And I just wonder, is that extra stress on top of the cortisol spike actually doing me any good? Or would you rather suggest to do it at a different time of day?
So I'm gonna refer listeners to a podcast that I did with a guy named Mike Tipton, who I'd argue knows more about cold water immersion than anyone else on the planet. He's studied it for most of his career, which has been a relatively long and illustrious career.
Did you say Mike
And
Tilton?
Tipton,
Tipton.
TIPTON.
Okay, I'm going to put that
And
down in the link. So.
sure, I spoke with him about this subject a little bit. And I think that there are some general comments that I'll stand by over the years to come and that are unlikely to change. So, first, if we're thinking about cold water immersion and how people practice that, then I think that it's not just the cold water that is doing any heavy lifting if we're considering the beneficial effects of the cold water immersion, because the way that many people practice this is to go, for instance, swimming in the ocean, especially down in Europe. The average water temperature around the UK is about 12 degrees Celsius. And so you see all of these cold water swimmers, sometimes out in January, crazy, and they learn to love it. There's a strong community that comes with it. That's good for them. They're spending time outdoors in daylight. That's good for them. They're exposed to nature. That's good for them. So there are all these confounding factors that mean that if we were trying to interpret any associations between cold water swimming and health outcomes, we need to try and account for those other factors too. So often there are many other positive things that come with the cold water immersion that are independently good for people. If we're thinking about isolated cold water immersion, so let's say that you have a cold plunge at home, then I think right now the weight of the evidence shows that there are some things that you really need to consider quite carefully in trying to work out whether it's right for you and how to best use it. So there are some potentially positive effects in the short term on things like your alertness, and that's to do with that stress response that I mentioned earlier. And it could be that there are some small changes in various different metabolic functions that take place in response to that cold immersion, like increased brown adipose tissue thermogenesis, depending on who you are. And there could be some changes on some immune parameters too. You might find that using cold immersion does reduce the amount of exercise-induced muscle damage and delayed onset muscle soreness that you experience. But the timing does matter, and how you practice this does matter too. And I know that speaking with Mike, he rarely sees an instance where there's any substantial benefit in going beyond about the 2 minute mark if you were looking to use this on a regular basis, because you get the cold shock response within the first 2 minutes, and you get some other responses too that might be beneficial without the potential dangers that come with longer cold exposure, non-freezing injuries and that type of thing. And so if you're going to practice this, I would keep the exposures relatively short, no more than 2 minutes on a daily basis if you're going to use it. The specific parts of your body that you expose to the cold matters as well. And you can actually use a graded process here where you might start with just your hands or your feet, use what's called a cold presser test. And that way you'll get some acclimation to the cold exposure. And then from there, you can increase the surface area of your body that you expose to the cold. But what I wouldn't do is submerge your head in the cold if you're using this on a regular basis, because it can produce what Mike has coined autonomic conflict, where you've got the cold shock response, you've got this big increase in output of the sympathetic branch of the autonomic nervous system. So you've got this rise in stress hormones, for instance, and change in heart rate and so on. But alongside that, you also have what's called the diving reflex. And that specifically happens if you expose your face to water. And that actually produces changes in the parasympathetic branch of the autonomic nervous system that tell your heart to slow down. And what you end up having is this unusual state in which you've got the sympathetic fibers going into the heart telling it to speed up and the parasympathetic ones telling it to slow down. That produces this type of autonomic conflict. And when combined with a breath hold, as is often practiced, it consistently produces an arrhythmia, even in healthy people. And so I don't want to sound like I'm scaremongering here, but suffice it to say that if you're going to use cold exposure, I think the safest way to do it on a regular basis is head out immersion and focus on your breathing and not holding your breath, keeping the exposure short. And then finally coming to the time of day, I touched on how the circadian system primes your cardiovascular system for physical activity and stress a bit later in the day. And so if you're going to use this early in the day, it's probably not the ideal time for it, because you are more likely to experience some sort of adverse response. But a lot of people want to use it early in the day because they feel that it wakes them up because of the cold shock response. So I would certainly wait a bit of time after waking before using it. And we can probably use similar guidelines to what I said regarding strenuous exercise earlier on, because that also is acutely stressful to the heart, but ultimately good for it. If anything, I'd maybe plug this into the day a little bit later than that. But there's an interaction with exercise too. And there's some evidence that cold exposure can actually blunt some adaptations to exercise training. And so using it straight after training, for the most part, isn't something you'd want to do necessarily, unless you were, say, an athlete and you were competing in a multi-day event and you just needed to reduce your muscle soreness as much as possible after each session. And then at the other end of the day, I also wouldn't have the cold exposure too close to bed because of the sympathetic activation that you get and the fact that that can wake you up. So I'd certainly not use this within, again, 3 hours of the end of the day. But basically, if we think about both of those considerations, the middle of the waking day is probably the ideal time for this type of exposure. It's far enough from bed to avoid any potential effects on sleep, but it's far enough into the day that your cardiovascular system is now less vulnerable. And then regarding sauna, it's a slightly tricky one because I'm personally much more bullish about the health benefits of sauna exposure and cold immersion. And I think that they're very well borne out by the research. And if you heat your skin about 1 to 2 hours before bed by way of a hot shower or a hot bath, then that's consistently been shown to help improve sleep. And counterintuitively, it does so in part by reducing your core body temperature around the start of the sleep period, because you radiate heat out from your core in response to heating your skin temperature by 1 to 2 degrees Celsius. But if you're using the sauna, then the thermal stress can be high enough that you end up storing heat. So you're raising your skin temperature, but you're also raising your core body temperature too. And so the longer the sauna session, the higher the temperature of the sauna. So if you're using a Finnish sauna, say, and it was 90 degrees Celsius, and you were in there for half an hour in total, I would want that to be quite far ahead of sleep. And recommendations would probably be quite similar to strenuous exercise again. However, if you were using an infrared sauna and it was 60 degrees Celsius and you were in there for 15 minutes, then I think you could probably do that up to about 2 hours before bed without any issues. And you might find that it positively affects your sleep because you're not raising your core temperature that much. You're getting some positive effects of the red light therapy or the near infrared therapy, and you're raising your skin temperature too, and then that's going to actually support that drop in core temperature that we're looking for. So hopefully that there are some practical recommendations within there too, but basically the longer and the higher the temperature of the sauna session, the earlier it should be. The middle of the waking day is probably the ideal time of day for the cold immersion, and slightly later on for the sauna therapy.
Makes perfect sense to me. I'll try that more and more. I find ice bath in the morning too hard for me, which is why I probably do it 2 or 3 hours after. To me, that feels good. And what you refer to with the sauna makes perfect sense to you. So it's kind of, you know, you always have a gut feeling, hey, but then it's great to hear from someone as yourself who's kind of really gone through papers and those sort of things are at the moment. But I'll definitely check out the podcast with Mike Lipton, put it down below in the show notes too. Anything else? Any last point that maybe we haven't really covered that you could summarize in a minute or two, or you think we've painted a pretty good picture?
You asked about shift work earlier, and obviously that affects a lot of people. And shift work is difficult because there are so many different permutations of it. There are people that work rotating shifts, fixed shifts, there are interactions with chronotype. There are all these factors that make giving hard and fast recommendations a bit tricky. There's an app that I came across recently made by Stephen Lockley and his colleagues that I haven't personally used, but I suspect it's very good because their other app is excellent. The app that they first launched is called Time Shifter, and the jet lag app specifically.
I'm using that
which
one.
Which is great. If you're a regular traveler, it works fantastically well for most people. And I say that because I use it myself, and it's based on very well done modeling of how the circadian system responds to light in particular and how sleep homeostasis responds to caffeine. And they've launched this shift work app too. Given how good their jet lag app is, I suspect that the Time Shifter shift work app is also excellent. So I would point people in the direction of that. I've got no affiliation with it whatsoever, but that might be helpful for many of you. And then otherwise, I would just spell out that I think an understanding of chronobiology actually has really far-reaching implications. And you can think about many instances of this. So if you take the example of daylight savings time, then the scientific evidence clearly shows that it's bad news at the level of the population. there is, for example, a spike in traffic accidents that take place at that time, which is probably in part related to sleep loss, but might also reflect circadian disruption. There are instances of parts of the world being in the wrong time zone when you look at the actual longitudes that they're in. So, for example, all of China follows Beijing time because that's where the dictator is. But you might be several hours outside of the Beijing time zone, so you should not be following that time. So there are definitely some issues to iron out there. And then when we think about medicine at large, then I spoke earlier about the fact that the circadian system influences digestion and metabolism and excretion of various different substances. And that goes for medications too. And so where this is heading is that if we can better understand somebody's chronotype and better understand the best time of day at which to take drugs in terms of their absorption, distribution, metabolism, and excretion, the pathways that are involved, any effects of the medication on the sleep-wake cycle, then we might be able to improve the efficacy of the medications, but also reduce the potential for adverse effects too. And ultimately, that's going to save healthcare systems quite a lot of money. But to give some examples of that, there is clear evidence showing that some arthritis medications are best taken in the evening because many symptoms peak at night and in the early morning too. So if you take a glucocorticoid for your osteoarthritis, then you might find that the next morning your joints feel a bit better. If you look at statin use, then the rate limiting step in cholesterol synthesis is at its highest rate in the afternoon. And so taking statins around that time seems to be most effective. If you look at what are called non-dippers, people whose blood pressure doesn't dip overnight the way that it should, but then taking their hypotensive blood pressure medications late in the day seems to be best because it supports that overnight drop in blood pressure and therefore reduce their cardiovascular risk. So there are all these instances where I think chronobiology has important implications for medicine at large. And then obviously there's how we structure our days. We've touched on this in the context of exercise and nutrition, but this is also relevant to things like knowledge work. So how productive are you at work? How much of a toll does your work take because of how it eats into your sleep-wake schedule as a result of everything you have to do around your work in terms of getting to work and so on? And so I'd encourage people who are in positions that are influential to carefully consider that. And simple changes like letting people who are working shifts know their schedules several weeks in advance can meaningfully improve quality of life. Giving people some flexibility in their working hours to account for the fact that there are large differences between people of the same age and biological sex and their chronotypes is a good thing, because that way you're less likely to encroach on their sleep and just more likely to have happy, healthy, productive employees. So I think all of this stuff matters in terms of the big picture too. And this isn't just about micromanaging your day. It actually is something that is quite profoundly influential at the level of society at large.
Yeah. I mean, I look forward to reading more about it because to me it makes so much sense, and it seems to be largely underestimated or undervalued in our day-to-day narrative. And you know, I come from my dad is a doctor, he's a psychiatrist, my brother is a doctor, right? And you know, in these conversations, we've never spoken about the time of day. So if you got a headache or you got, you know, inflammation, just take it. Yeah. And that's obviously on a much smaller scale, but imagine that actually being in the hospital, you know, how much good you could actually do if there was actually knowledge around that. So, yeah, you got to run, eh? So,
yeah.
Yeah, so good. I could listen to you for hours, man. Like, so fascinating. So I hope we'll do another episode at some point in the future, maybe in person or in a diving spot somewhere. We'll see where the world takes
us.
Thanks so much for sharing your wisdom with us. We'll link everything we talked about sort of down below, so hopefully someone follows you, or you know, there will be someone who, you know, ask questions. But have a cracking day. Thanks so much for everything. Be in touch.
Thanks, Giannis. Pleasure. Take care, mate.
Cheers. Bye-bye.
We hope you got a lot out of today's inspiring conversation. please share this episode with someone you know needs to hear it. Whether they are a seasoned health expert or just beginning their wellness journey, these stories of remarkable transformation, success, and valuable insights will certainly help empower more people. Until next time, have the best life ever.